सदा मस्त कलंदर ਸਦਾ ਮਸਤ ਕਲੰਦਰ ਤੇਰੇ ਦਰ ਤੇ ਮੈਂ
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
My friend Teddy almost set his house on fire. He used a counterfeit, you know, a fake wall charger.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.org.
We're here on Forbes Avenue, which is on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Katrina Darms.
Hello.
So, one really cool thing that has been happening on campus and around Pittsburgh in general is that CAT has been running mending workshops. So, what does a mending workshop look like when you're leading it?
Yeah, so I run mending workshops on campus at TechSpark and at Hunt Library, and they look a little different. So at TechSpark, we have sewing machines. At Hunt, that's not available. And then the public ones also no sewing machines. But basically, a mending workshop is people bring clothes that are damaged in some way. They maybe have a rip or a worn area, or they just want to, like, shorten a T-shirt or a pair of pants. And I'll give them the supplies, show them how to do that, give them a little demo, and then they just sew it. They fix it themselves. It's a lot of different kinds of skills today. I just actually came from one at TechSpark. So it was a lot of denim repairs, because that's like a thing that kind of people have that lasts a long time usually, but and doesn't go out of style quickly, but gets worn out, especially like people call like chub rub, the like area between your legs kind of wears out. So people repairing that, people repairing like a shoe with a hole in it.
How did you start running these workshops?
Yeah, so I started working at TechSpark, which is the makerspace on campus, when I was a sophomore. And they have sewing machines there. And so I was kind of started by showing my friends like how to fix things. My roommate had like a pair of pants she wanted to take in at the waist, and a rip in her backpack. And then she was kind of so amazed, like she was really excited to have done it, you know? And to me, like I had been sewing since I was in middle school. It was kind of just something that I taught myself to do. It didn't feel that it felt very like achievable in a way because it was kind of so self-taught. But for people who didn't start learning when they were younger, it feels like a lot more like of a in like the higher barrier to entry kind of. And so I started teaching the workshops there because I realized that there was a desire for it. Like people who would maybe want to repair something but didn't have the skills and didn't feel like they could attain the skills on their own would want to learn.
So why do you have any ideas on why people, you learned in middle school, but many people don't. Do you know why that might be?
Yeah. So, I mean, historically, there was a fairly robust like home economics program in schools. But recently, that's kind of been dying out. I didn't get taught it at all in school. I don't know if you did.
No, I did not.
Yeah. So I was actually reading an article about this from Rebecca Harrison, who's the owner of Old Flame Mending, which is a mending shop in Pittsburgh. And she was kind of saying that a lot of public school funding recently has been kind of more directed at towards passing tests and standardized testing. And there's no standardized testing for like mending a rip, following a recipe, budgeting your own finances. And so there's kind of been a transition and focus away from that, those kind of skills. And also at the same time, like clothes are much cheaper now than they were, right? When home ec was first started, like clothes were expensive because fabrics were higher quality. Everything was made in the U.S. primarily, and people just didn't have as much. And so you needed to be able to fix it, right? Because you couldn't afford to replace it. But now things are much more replaceable. And so people don't feel the need to learn those kind of skills.
What would you say is causing clothes to become so much more replaceable then?
Fast fashion is like one of the primary targets. I mean, even before, so fast fashion has been like accelerating really, really rapidly and with crazy trend cycles. But even starting in like the 90s, kind of clothes started getting moved offshore because of these free trade agreements that allowed like there's policies that make it possible for there to be like what's called import export zones in other countries, which are kind of areas right at shipping towns, basically like ports. Thank you. So areas near ports where they'll bring in like fabric that's manufactured maybe in the U.S. because we do grow a fair amount of cotton, but also or manufactured somewhere else, but by a U.S. company, and bring them into places like Nicaragua and Honduras where people will be paid like really small wages to assemble them into clothes and then shipped back out without paying tariffs to the U.S. Or like the same type of tariffs, basically. And so it allows us to manufacture clothes much more cheaply for the U.S. market, but without kind of, one, benefiting the people making the clothes, without really benefiting the land, right? So we are also making a lot more clothes out of polyester today than ever before, which also makes it easier to make them more cheaply because you don't actually have to, you just have to extract oil, which is kind of cheap these days, I guess. And it kind of doesn't, human hands don't have to touch it nearly as much as they historically did.
So with all this cheap clothes that's made out of plastic and doesn't last as long, I imagine we have a pretty significant waste problem with clothes.
Yes, for sure. So, I mean, the polyester is creating microplastics like every time you wash it. Everybody is kind of consuming clothes as though they're disposable. You'll buy a shirt maybe and it rips after a few wears, right? Because it's made poorly. And then either people donate it, right? But if it's ripped, no one really wants it, but people still will donate damaged clothing. Either they'll throw it away, right? And then it's just going into landfills in the U.S. Or they'll donate it. But even places like Goodwill, they'll only sell less than half of the clothes that they receive. I think estimates vary, but I've also seen as low as like 25% gets sold. And the rest gets shipped to other countries. So, and they're just into kind of massive piles, basically. But yeah, so it gets shipped to other countries where it floods the local textile markets, which makes it really hard for people to make money making clothes in those countries, right? Because it's so cheap to buy like secondhand U.S. clothes or American clothes. And it also creates a massive amount of waste. So there's just, which can be a fire hazard, can be like a hazard to, like, I've seen there's like huge just piles of clothes in open landfills that like blow off like onto roads, creating a hazard on roads, and or get like burned, which creates air pollution in those countries. So yeah, no, definitely a massive waste problem.
So I know some people try and recycle clothing. Is that like a feasible way to address the issue?
Yeah. So there are a bunch of recycling efforts. I don't know a ton about it, but I think the challenge is sorting, right? Because nowadays, a lot of clothes, even if they aren't 100% polyester, it's going to be partially polyester. If you have like, if you have kind of virgin material, that's what it's called, or like where it's all one, all made of one material, it's easier to unply and then make it back into fibers, which you can spin into thread again and into, and then weave into clothing or knit into clothing, or into fabric. Whereas if you have kind of, it's 90% polyester, 10% cotton, it's really difficult to know kind of the makeup of every piece that you're putting into the cycle, I guess. And also kind of as you recycle, the staple length, which is like the length of the fibers in the thread gets shorter, right? Because it gets torn often when you're recycling. So it's harder to make like long lasting things out of recycled materials. You can make, there's a lot of work doing like making rugs out of recycled materials. So I mean, I don't know what the one we're standing on is made of, but because it's shorter and it doesn't need to like withstand kind of pulling or tension at all, it's easier to make stuff like that, or insulation. I also saw something recently about people making like insulation panels out of recycled clothing. They would mix the recycled fibers with like a starch-based solution. And it was like even more effective than foam or like carved insulation panels. So I'm curious about that as well. But yeah, it can be hard to kind of take it from clothing into more clothing because of the different makeups of all the different clothes. And also, like, if you have anything with buttons on it, right, somebody has to cut the buttons off individually. Or often people, things have, like, there will be like a different lining versus the outer fabric. So it's just a challenge. It requires a lot of labor. And at this point, because it's so cheap to manufacture more clothes, it's just not really worth it.
So I know corporations have it cheap to make clothes. Do you feel like social media also contributes to the overconsumption, I would say?
Yes. I think historically, there's sort of been what's known as the trend cycle, which lasts about 20 years. So you'll see like the styles of the 80s kind of come back in the 2000s. And also like the sort of short skirts of the 60s in the mod era come back in the 80s, right? And same with kind of shapes and silhouettes of clothing. And that's kind of recently been very accelerated, right? So we had the sort of 90s era in the 2010s, but then it already had gone to the 2000s, like much faster than it like would have been. And then that sort of gets exhausted really quickly. Same with prints. Like you see sort of a print or a specific color will like come in and out of fashion in a year or even like 3 months, right? And it's because people, I think, I mean, I don't want to like pathologize, right? But like people are so into like what's new. Because, and also I think what's really wonderful in one way also has a bad effect. So like, I think social media has made us all really like intent on kind of individuality, right? And I think that was obviously already like a part of life, right? Everyone wants to seem unique. But because we're exposed to so many other people, right, on social media, and so many people who are like the best at getting dressed and the best at looking nice, you know, we are comparing ourselves to them and saying, oh, well, like, they're so good at getting dressed and looking pretty. I should be that good, you know? And you're seeing so many different ways that a person can do that. You want to be as individual, as unique as they are. And so if you see a piece online that you think is, like, really cute, it has this new type of polka dots you've never seen, right? Like, yeah, I would love that. But then that kind of style, maybe you bought it from like a unique Etsy seller, right? But then that style, the Sheins and the Temus of the world are like also looking at all of the Etsy shops that are designing really unique clothing, and they are copying that so quickly. And then they are putting that out on their, like onto their site within like days, actually. Just totally copied designs, which is also horrible for the people making the clothing, right? Who've worked so hard on designing this clothes that's much more high quality than what Temu and Shein are making. But and then that becomes mass manufactured, right? And then somebody else is wearing it and you're like, oh, wait, but that was my special unique thing. What do you mean you also have it? And so it kind of, and then maybe it makes you not want to wear it because then people are going to think you're wearing Shein and then you feel like you're wearing Shein, right? So it's kind of an insidious cycle. But I think, yeah, I think definitely social media contributes to the acceleration of trend cycles just because it kind of makes things played out more quickly. You know what I mean?
I do. Recently this summer, I was seeing underconsumption core become big on social media.
Yes.
Which seemed kind of ironic to me because we're making a micro trend out of not consuming.
Yes. I'd say more power to them. Like, I think it is really funny. And I saw a video making fun of underconsumption that was like her, like, say using the sound that somebody else had made and then showing off all her cups. But then everyone in the comments was like, what are you doing? Like, this is actually the first good thing we've ever seen on social media. Like, why would you make fun of it? But I think it is really encouraging. I think a lot of people are kind of resisting the corporatization and like kind of like you can tell often when you're consuming content that it is kind of
made to make money and made because this person is sponsored by that. Like, it'll say hashtag ad, right? But you still like watch the haul, you know? And so I think people are kind of reacting to that and pushing back on kind of being told that they always need more stuff, which I think is really wonderful. I also think like there's a lot of people in our generation who are much more motivated by sustainability. And I think that that is like a huge part of why the fashion industry is bad, right? Is its consumption. And so I think hopefully reacting to that as well.
Yeah. So a bit ago, you mentioned designers. And you actually are somewhat of a designer yourself, aren't you? Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I have done most of my work is more focused on like repair and alterations. And I think in general, like I kind of struggle with like designing clothing or making new things out of new products, you know, just because so much of fashion and new clothing is tied to consuming new resources and which feels very unnecessary. But despite all that, I did last year design for a fashion show at CMU called Lunar Gala. It's actually the largest fashion show in Pittsburgh by like attendance, I think. But it was a really fun experience. I did it with my roommate at the time. And our whole line was inspired by the insects. The theme of the show was like liminality. And so we were kind of looking at that through the lens of like an insect's life. It's so brief and it's always like metamorphosing, who knows, into a new sort of phase. And so we kind of looked at that and were inspired by like bug shapes and textures and colors to create a line of just very weird avant-garde clothes. But it was really fun. It was a really unique opportunity to like try out a bunch of new skills. There were a lot of kind of clothing construction techniques that I had never tried before that I was curious about. And so it was like really awesome to learn how to drape and to learn how to kind of sew a crotch zipper and to like experiment with puffy things. It was just a really fun time to do it and to do it with my friend who, and just like kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and playing around with shape and pattern and color can be a very fun experience, even when it feels like, oh no, I'm consuming too many resources.
Awesome. So we're here on Forbes Avenue. I'm Riona Duncan. I'm interviewing Kat Darms. We're talking about fashion and mending and all that kind of thing.
Indeed.
Anyways, speaking of, you know, the more art side to working with fabric. I also know that you have a show you were considering putting on.
Yes. So if you heard of the Frame Gallery on Forbes Avenue, literally Forbes Avenue, me and a friend named Luca are working on a textile art show there, hopefully sometime in the spring. There's a lot of different textile artists working at CMU. We have like a really awesome costume department with costume designers who are doing really creative work. We have sort of a textile lab through the mechanical engineering department where they work on kind of using weaving machines and knitting machines to generate like digitally generated art on textiles in really incredible ways and working with, you can like create images, but you can also kind of create interesting patterns and textures and ways that the cloth moves. And then also there's an Ideate department, which is kind of a combination of arts and technology. And they have a whole soft technologies program that I've taken a few classes in where they're doing really cool stuff with dyes, natural dyes and synthetic dyes, as well as kind of 3D artworks that incorporate technology in some ways or don't, you know. And then there's also like obviously the art department and they have really cool programs doing soft sculpture as well as like painting on fabric. And so we kind of wanted to create a place to allow all of those interests to come together and for people to see the kind of possibilities of soft technology or of soft sculpture, soft technology, soft art in general. And like kind of the breadth of ideas that are out there.
Well, we'll definitely have to check it out. So given you've worked both with the more fine art side of it and the mending hands-on part, where would you say the line falls between craft and art?
Whoa. Interesting question. I would say I don't know that there is a super fine line. I think historically the kind of distinction has been very gendered there. there's sort of this idea that, like, sewing is women's work and that makes it not art, you know? I think, like, obviously people will accept that, like, haute couture, like, is art, right? But historically, that's also dominated by male designers, as opposed to, like, and they wouldn't consider kind of the bead artists who are working on the Alexander McQueen gown to be artists. They would be like, oh, that's a craftsperson, even though they are creating the thing that you would call art, you know? So I don't know. I think it's very challenging. There's also, like, it's also interesting how it kind of changes throughout time. Like, I don't know if you've heard of the G's Bend quilters. So these are, like, artists historically. There was, like, a textile tradition in G's Bend, Alabama. They were, so it had been, like, a plantation. And then there was, like, a quilting co-op in the early 20th century there. And they sort of used scrap fabrics to create these really beautiful abstract quilts. And they were selling them for, like, $5 just to make money for their community, you know. I don't know exactly his name, but, like, some art collector, like, discovered them, you know, discovered in air quotes, and then started selling them on an international stage. And they got, like, a ton of acclaim, right? Because they were these incredible abstract artworks using color and pattern in really interesting ways at kind of the same time as, like, abstract art in painting was kind of coming out. And, like, the Bauhaus was making, like, abstract art, like, a bigger kind of thing, you know? And they were, like, right at the same time, like, pushing this forward. But for a long time, it was just considered, like, oh, that's craft because it's utility. It's for an object that would just be in your house. And it's, like, not a technique maybe that people are thinking of as fine art, you know. But, yeah, so I think, I don't know. I don't think that there is a super fine line. I think that that's going to change with time and with place and with, like, who is doing it.
So you mentioned that historically sewing has definitely been seen as women's work.
Yeah.
Do you think that's affected how it's kind of, I don't want to say fallen out of vogue, but become of a less common skill lately?
Yeah, I could totally see that. I mean, I think, like, people, men are certainly less inclined to do it because of that. At my mending workshops, it's frequently many more women than men, though I did actually have one that was more men than women, so that was exciting. It was at Trace Brewing, and it was funny to me that it was like, oh yeah, the brewery gets all the guys, I guess. I don't know. Women also, there's been a sort of return to craft recently, and, like, fiber crafts on social media are, like, very popular, knitting and crocheting. But I do think that kind of during, like, second wave feminism, there was kind of a removal from things that were traditionally feminine, and that was sort of seen as maybe less desirable skills, or, like, it sort of, as women were entering the workforce, they didn't want to also be expected to, like, keep up with the mending, you know? And so I think that could totally be a viable explanation for why it's, like, kind of gone down in recent years.
Yeah. I mean, also, garment workers tend to be majority women, but they don't tend to get paid very well, do they?
Definitely true. Yeah. No, there's been, yeah. No, the treatment of garment workers historically has been really, really terrible. And I mean, like, we all in the U.S. learn about, like, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And then it's sort of like, oh, yeah, and that was 1911. And then they passed the laws to fix the problem. And now it's fine. But really, we just sort of exported the problem to Southeast Asia and to Central America, where people are still struggling with really, really awful conditions and really unsafe conditions. I don't know if you've heard of the Rana Plaza collapse in 2013. It was, like, a very famous collapse of a textile factory, or, like, garment factory, and thousands of people died. And it was kind of the same, like, people were not in safe conditions and they knew it, and they still continued to force people to work there. So, yeah, I think the problems have not been solved. And, like, they're not going to be solved if people continue to purchase clothes that they know are made in these horrible conditions. Like, obviously it would be great if the government stepped in and, like, prevented that, but we are not seeing any signs of that happening, and so I think it is kind of on us as consumers. Like, I don't want to, like, guilt anyone, of course, for, like, making the choices that they make. And I think also it's totally fair to, if you can't afford to buy fancy clothes, you know, to buy fast fashion sometimes. But it's more about, like, the overconsumption than it is about, like, the actual place that you're purchasing the clothes from.
Yeah. So if you could tell me how a world
where people actually kept this into account and garment workers got treated better and we had better clothes, how we would get there, do you think?
Wow. Okay, well, I think it starts by kind of just buying way less stuff. I think it's hard when you're a teenager and your body is changing and you kind of have to, and also like the things that are acceptable for you to wear are changing. But like once you're kind of, I'm 22 and I feel like since I was 17 or 18, my size has not changed that much and my style has honestly not changed that much. And so like I just don't need to buy that many clothes, you know. Maybe you need to replace some things that are getting very worn, but most things you can repair on your own. And especially if you're kind of shopping more conscientiously, I guess, you choose pieces that you really care about, you know, and you only buy things when it looks like something that you're really interested in. And so then you care more about that garment. And so you're more likely to repair it when it's damaged. And yeah, I think everyone would have these kind of skills, have the ability to fix their clothes, have the ability to tailor their clothes to fit them. Because I also think we have kind of moved away from a society where things are made to order, you know, like historically kind of all clothes were made for a person as opposed to for this generic size that was kind of arbitrary and also created not off of a diverse set of body types. And so clothes are kind of sized as to fit the smallest person, but just if they were scaled up, which is just not how people grow, you know? But I think like, so if that could be changed, that would be great. But also having the ability ourselves to alter clothes to fit our bodies so that we feel more comfortable and more confident in them. And then, yeah, once clothes kind of reach the end of their viable life, using those fabric scraps for something else if possible. Yeah, and I think if we were kind of consuming much less, we could afford to pay more for the things that we were buying. And so then the garment workers could be paid more for their work. And maybe we could stop making things out of polyester altogether, perhaps, except like, I guess, a raincoat that needs to be like plastic. But even that, like you can do canvas and beeswax, but I'm not like I'm not going full like trad wife on it. But I do think like if we bought less, we could pay more and we could have people paid fair wages for their work.
Do you find that people take better care and use pieces more as foundational that they hold on to a while if they end up mending them?
Yes. I mean, I've definitely found that in my own closet, like the pieces that I have sort of, because it's the clothes that you like the most, you wear the most, and so they're the first to get damaged, you know? And so those are the clothes that I have to mend first. And so they are just like it feels much more special to me after I've put an hour or two into fixing it, you know, because, and it's also, it is more unique, you know, no one else has a piece of clothing that looks exactly like this because I have stitched it myself. And I do, I mean, I guess I don't know exactly the end result of my menders because often I never see them again. They come once, they learn the skill, they leave. But they often do seem like very excited about the piece, especially because it's like your favorite pair of shorts and then you couldn't wear them for like a month or two or a year or two, you know, they've been in the back of your closet and then you pull them out, you fix them and then suddenly it's like reintroduced to you and it is very exciting and it kind of generates a more care about the things that we wear. And I think that that doesn't even just apply to clothing. I think caring more about the things that you have, it sounds kind of materialistic, but I think in another way, it just connects us more to like the objects that are in our lives in a really wonderful way.
Speaking of it also making the pieces more unique, do you tend to use visible mending as one of your techniques?
Yes, I love visible mending. I think my two most favorite like visible mending techniques, I guess, are like darning, which is kind of creating, basically you create like a weaving over top of a hole in a garment. And that's mostly commonly used on knitwear. And I often do it in like a contrasting color. So it pops out a little bit and you can do it with like patterns. You can do it in like fun shapes. And then also sashiko, which is historically a Japanese technique that was used to strengthen fabric, but also to patch holes. And it just consists of like really long running stitches, sometimes covering like an area that's worn, sometimes covering like the whole garment. And you can create like really intricate patterns with the running stitches because they're going in different directions. They can create like stars or boxes, shapes, or just like these really incredible patterns if you look up sashiko. And yeah, it came out of Japan in a time when cloth was really expensive. And the country was kind of in poverty in like the Meiji period, I think. But then it kind of became a style, right? There were like different different patterns of sashiko were associated with different places in Japan and different like subcultures. And now it's kind of one of the most famous visible mending techniques. And I think it's kind of the best way to patch denim by hand because it does strengthen the fabric and it doesn't, it's kind of straightforward, right? It's simple. The stitch itself is not hard to do. It's one of the most basic stitches, but you can create a really awesome effect. And I love it when like I'll kind of show somebody that and then I'll be like, oh, and you can look at all these colors. You can choose a color that matches. And they're like, oh, wait, I kind of want a color that doesn't match. Like I want it to pop. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought you'd never ask. But yeah, no, I really enjoy visible mending. I think it kind of conveys the meaning that we should care about our clothes, right? Anytime you wear clothes, you're saying something about who you are and what you care about, whether that's kind of not like announced out loud or not. And I think visible mending makes the statement, hey, I really care about keeping what I have and repairing things. And I think that's a wonderful statement to make.
That's awesome. We are running out of time. So is there anything else you want to say?
I would say come to my mending workshops.
Absolutely. Please tell us when and where.
Yeah. I have, so on Instagram at mendwithkat, you can find all the information. Weekly workshops at CMU are Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays at TechSpark 5 to 7, Tuesdays in Hunt Library 5 to 7. And then I also have public workshops. The next one coming up is going to be at Creative Reuse on October 26th, which is a Sunday. 12 to 3 p.m. I think. And yeah, they're really fun. It's a good time. Just bring something you want to mend.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. Once again, I'm Riona Duncan. I've been here with Katrina Darms on Forbes Avenue with WRCT Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
Ready?
Welcome to Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio, or the Roots Program, depending on where you are listening. I am Mando Richard, and I'm not able to make it into the studio today, so I'm going to pre-record today's show, and I'm sure you will enjoy it. Let's get that liquored up set started, shall we? It's all going to be songs about the bottle. First one's from Junior Sisk and Rambler's Choice. If the bottle was a Bible.
For 2 years, that old man lives in here, drinks all night and peels off all the labels. I sit back and watch him go as he lines them up all in a row. Side by side, he sets them at his table. I bet he's memorized those words printed on the side. God knows that man has read those lines 1,000 times. Imagine what he'd know if the bottle was a Bible. I bet he's drank Jordan. The flesh is weaker than what they
prophet to the drinking man in a haze of neon lights and tortured souls. But for him, it's gin and misery, dying in her loving memory since he laid her in that field of granite stone. Best left on the vine. All she probably turned the water into wine. I bet he's drank the River Jordan. The flesh is weaker than what they're pouring. Is weaker than what they're pouring, and right there in that bar he'd have revival if the bottle was a Bible. Yeah, right there in that bar he'd have revival if the bottle was a Bible.
Situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Good evening, friends. You're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast. with Mandolin Richard. No, it's Mando Richard, isn't it?
For sure.
Cut! I don't do well under pressure, people! Give him a quart. Hello, friends. Brian Oberlin here. You're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with Mando Richard, the finest name in all the mandolin business.
could wash my cares away. I put off thinking till tomorrow. Rode in drinking for today. And I got one more $2 Agave tequila bottle to keep you off my mind for one more day. No more heartache, sorrow, till the sun comes up tomorrow and reminds me that your loving's gone away. Is this your first time in Reynosa? Barman pours my double shot. There's a girl who's staring at me. She's standing over by the bed. She calls me over with her fingertip. Lights the smoke and takes my hand. Says I got one more.
Background, you're listening to Bigfoot play Chase the Squirrel from their 2012 record I've Got a Bulldog. And that's what you listen to while I tell you about our liquored up set of music here on Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio or the Roots Program. If the Bottle Was a Bible is how we open up today's show from Junior Sisk and Rambler's Choice 2013 record The Story of the Day That I Died. Then you heard a great old song from Lester Flatt and the Nashville Grass, The House of Bottles and Cans, from Lester Flatt and the Nashville Grass's 1976 LP Heaven's Bluegrass Band. And after the PSA, you heard from Victor Furtado and his pals doing Dance All Night with a Bottle in Your Hand from Victor Furtado's 2018 release, Delorto Island. Then the last thing in the set was Grain Thief doing Tequila Bottle from their 2020 record, Gasoline. Peter Mulvey is going to start off the next set of music here on Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio or the Roots Program.
When this bird has flown, when spring has sprung, when what you used to know, like the back of your hand, isn't even on the tip of your tongue. When the chips have settled, when the dust is down, when you've washed off the Greek's paint and you're still a clown. Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you? When the bottle is empty, when the money is gone, when you are just another angry old man shouting, get off of my lawn. When your tree has fallen and there was no one to hear it, when your heart is a cornered stray and you can't get near it. Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Bottom dollar has gone to the last top dog. When the princess has kissed you soundly and you are still a frog. When there's no way through, the only way is out. When it's all over but the shouting and you're too tired to shout. Who's gonna love you?
Echo.
to sit and get ripe like a plum.
Shine.